Hi, and welcome to another Glenn and Helen podcast with our guest, Claire Berlinski.
We're talking to Claire Berlinski, author of Menace in Europe, Why the Continent's Crisis is America's Too. Claire spent the last several years living in Paris and more recently Istanbul. She's now back in the United States promoting her book. We're glad to have you here.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Claire, why should Americans worry about Europe's crisis? Isn't Europe always in some sort of crisis?
Well, that is exactly why Americans should worry. Historically, that's been where the most American blood and treasure has been squandered in the past century. The reason we need to worry about Europe, in short, is because that's the other half of the Western world. And because, as we're increasingly discovering, we really are hamstrung without European cooperation. And in every aspect of American foreign policy, every aspect, the fact that we have a recalcitrant, uncooperative Europe is really causing problems. As a counterfactual, let's imagine what Iraq policy might have looked like if we'd had Europe on board from the beginning, if we'd had an airtight sanctions regime, if we'd had troops from Europe supporting us, not that there haven't been troops from certain European countries, but an absolutely unified posture in diplomacy and in war would have made such a difference. Just
so
one example.
What should we do? Or, you know, can we? I mean, I know you say that European anti-Americanism is a faith-based cult.
Mm-hmm.
And how do you deal with a faith-based cult?
It's very difficult, and I don't think there are any easy solutions, but I think the first step is to understand what's going on. There are certain concrete things that recently have come to my mind. I was very, very dismayed by the American response to the cartoon crisis, but to the fact that we didn't stand up for the right side. The State Department's comments, and I don't know if everyone who's listening will be familiar with that, were really a disgrace. The Danes have a very noble record in Europe. The Danes have a historic record of bravery in the Second World War. The Danes adopted the Yellow Star and refused to allow the Nazis to round up and persecute their Jews. And it's really shameful that now the Danes again are standing up for these fundamental Enlightenment values alone, without American support.
Yeah, I actually wonder if the Bush administration's weakness on this front didn't come back and bite them on the ass in the response to the Dubai ports deal, that it's really undermined a lot of people's confidence in them in terms of standing up to this sort of thing.
That's an interesting point, do you think?
It does sort of seem that way. There seems kind of a yin and yang, an equal and opposite reaction there. I'm not sure, but somehow it feels that way.
Well, that's interesting. I wouldn't have thought the two were connected. Do you think the American public sees them as connected, really?
Well, I think that the cartoon wars gave the sense that there is this mass of angry Muslims out there who can't be trusted and who don't respect Western ideas. And then you've got this country with the unfortunate name of the United Arab Emirates involved. And I think the distrust had been heightened by the cartoon wars. And I think the Bush administration's sort of appeasing response on that front gave people a sense that they weren't strong enough.
So do you think Americans did see it as an appeasing response? Do you think most Americans were really dismayed by that?
I think so.
Good. I hope a lot of people were dismayed by that. They should be.
So what should we do? I mean, we're constantly told that America throws its weight around too much, and yet you're suggesting that that's wrong.
No, well, what do you mean by we're constantly told that America... By whom are we constantly told that America throws its weight around too much? By Europeans?
Mostly, yeah.
Yeah, well, they're wrong. They're wrong, and we need to be frank about that. We need to understand that when they say that, it's generally not because they have a special insight or wisdom that we're not privileged to have. Of course, there are legitimate criticisms of the United States. There will always be legitimate criticisms of a large nation made up of human beings. Of course, we make mistakes. But the level of condemnation has reached a certain kind of hysteria that is totally divorced from reality, where the United States is seen as the single worst, most villainous nation on the planet and the source of all foreign policy problems by a substantial number of Europeans. Not all of them, of course, but a significant number really believe this, and that's a hysteria.
This seems like Helen's area of expertise more, but they seem like angry adolescents.
I was just going to say, Helen, I would really be interested in what you have to say about this.
Well, I mean, it does seem that people are extremely angry, and I guess I wonder, where does that anger come from?
Mm-hmm.
I had a recent post looking at, for example, and this is something you talk about, is welfare in the European countries. The fact that a lot of Muslim immigrants, in fact, 40% of the welfare recipients in, I believe it's Denmark, are Muslim. And I wonder if that plays any part, for example, welfare benefits along with discrimination. How does that play itself out in how you know, Muslims are perceived in these European countries? And also, does it, do you think it relates in any way to terrorism?
When you talk about anger, are you talking about the anger that Europeans feel toward Americans or toward immigrants?
Oh, no, I'm talking about what they feel towards immigrants, not towards Americans, towards
right.
immigrants.
Well, I think that Europeans generally are very frightened of voicing anger toward mm-hmm. immigrants, even when those immigrants are behaving in ways that are very destructive.
Mm-hmm.
There are enormous social taboos against speaking frankly about problems with immigrants who are not assimilating, particularly Muslim immigrants who are not assimilating. And to some extent, those taboos are understandable. We're talking about the continent that gave us the Holocaust, and
right.
we want to be a little bit grateful that these taboos are now in place.
Right, but you think they're too extreme. It's gone
the
other way.
They've become so extreme that they've shaded into tolerating intolerance.
Right.
They've shaded into an inability to distinguish what a society can accept and what it absolutely cannot and remain a Western democratic liberal society.
Mm-hmm. And don't you think America is becoming somewhat like that also?
Well, that's one of the points that I think is important to stress, and it's one that I do stress in my book. When one of the reasons that Americans should care what's going on in Europe is because we're looking at a foretaste. We're looking at the natural end of certain ideas when they're taken to their extreme. They have not been taken to that extreme in America yet, but if they are, you end up with certain situations you see in Europe.
Could you describe some of those situations? What are the situations in Europe?
Or the ideas?
Mm-hmm.
Well, among the ideas is the idea of tolerance that has no bounds. The idea of tolerance that has no bounds and an absolute prohibition against criticizing anything that immigrants do.
Mm-hmm.
There are also other ideas, economic ideas, the social welfare state, cradle-to-grave socialism, which taken to its extreme has caused massive illogic in the labor market and has caused high unemployment throughout Europe. And this is contributing to the problems.
And what about the fact that I read in another book that many of the Muslims that receive the welfare money, for example, go and they get so angry they beat up the social workers in the welfare offices, and this is tolerated. Not only do the social workers tolerate it, say, in Denmark or the Netherlands, but they try to give more money in response to that anger. In other words, instead of doing anything active about the anger, they try to appease it with more money and with more tolerance.
Sure, absolutely. And there's a long tradition of doing that in Europe. Appeasement is a long European tradition.
I'm a believer psychologically that appeasement is not a good way to go.
No, absolutely it's not. But you would think that this lesson would have been comprehensively learned, and it hasn't been. I think the most obvious example is in Spain. The most obvious example is the train bombing that claimed lives of more than 200 Spanish citizens, which was immediately followed by the election of a government that proposed to capitulate to all the terrorist demands. And this is a terrible, terrible precedent. And what a signal this sends. What an encouragement to anyone who thinks that terrorism is likely to be effective. Terrible.
Mm-hmm.
If you were giving instrumental advice to the United States, would you suggest that the way to deal with Europe would be to act sufficiently frightening they would be inclined to appease us instead?
Well, you think Americans should take to the streets threatening to behead Europeans?
Well, I don't know. They were hot to appease the Soviets.
Come on, they know that we're not going to behead them.
They were hot to appease the Soviets. I mean, there are lots of ways to threaten people. I'm sort of being silly here, but on the other hand, once you establish, you know, what's going on, it's like the old joke. You're just haggling over the price.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think we have to take it on an issue-by-issue basis. There's obviously, you don't want to have a single diplomatic weapon, and there's many different ways you can approach this, and sometimes you're going to need to be seductive and offer a hand to the Europeans, and other times you're going to have to be tougher and threaten.
It really does, to go back to what I started to say earlier, it seems to me that the dynamic is kind of like dealing with a rebellious teenager. They've kind of got low self-esteem.
Very much so. But what I think is particularly important to stress and to understand, and this is what I think America should understand, is where these attitudes in Europe come from. And the important thing is that there have been two very significant historic events which have led to the Europe that we see today. And the first is the comprehensive death of religion in Europe, of Christianity, and the second is the two world wars. And any negotiations, any diplomacy that we have with Europe has to be undertaken with these things in mind to understand specific European sensibilities. If you don't understand, you can't construct an intelligent relationship.
Well, you know, it's funny. I had a conversation years ago when I was practicing law, and I had a client who was an older European fellow. It was a European client company, and he had escaped the Nazis from Poland and fought with the British and was head of a American subsidiary of a big European company. And he once said to me that you know, Europe had suffered such psychic trauma from World War One and World War Two that it would be 100 years after that before things were really anywhere normal.
Right, and not just 100 years. Not just 100 years. These are the kinds of traumas that I think take hundreds and hundreds of years to recover from.
How do you think assimilation plays a part? Say the immigrants in Europe. Do you think that assimilation, because a lot of the Muslim immigrants do not assimilate, mm-hmm. how does that play a part in, you know, keeping them isolated or more able to?
It's huge, Helen. It's very interesting to see. Even though Europe has had a long tradition of assimilating immigrants, it simply doesn't do it as well as the United States does. And every time I come back to the United States, I'm struck again by the genius of the United States assimilating immigrants. It's very, very obvious just here in Washington. I got here 24 hours ago, maybe 30 hours ago. And in that time, I've spoken to, about 15 immigrants from 15 different countries. Everyone I meet seems to be an immigrant. And it is very obvious that even though many of them have only arrived here recently, they consider themselves Americans, and they consider themselves very happy and lucky to be here. This is not something you find. This is not something you find in Europe.
You have this wonderful scene in your book where you talk about this Englishman of Bengali descent, and he said that when he traveled to the United States, he saw all these immigrants who were U.S. citizens being welcomed by the INS and told, "Welcome home." And he said, you know, if I ever got that kind of treatment, you know, when I returned to England, I'd happily lay down my life for England right there.
I would have died for England on the spot, that's what he told me.
Yes.
And once someone had said, "Welcome home," when I showed them my passport at Customs and Immigration, I would have died for England on the spot. Think about the lifetime of hurt behind a comment like that.
Think about the terrible social problem you've got when your model for compassion and welcome is the INS.
Actually, I have to say they are always very nice to me when I come home, and they do always say welcome home. But yeah.
I just found that such a striking example.
It is. It's a very striking example, but there's hundreds of examples like that, really hundreds. This is not to say that it's impossible for immigrants to succeed in Europe. It's certainly possible, and many people do immigrate to Europe, and they do manage to succeed extremely well. But Muslims in particular are having a very tough time of it. There are cultural reasons for this. There are historic reasons for this, and it is a major problem.
Jim Dunnigan was on with us recently, and he said part of the problem is that a lot of the immigrants to Europe from Muslim countries come in there from very rural backgrounds, much more primitive. The ones who come to the United States, I guess because it's a little farther, are generally better off, and that affects assimilation.
That's absolutely right. The United States immigration policy is different. We only accept immigrants who come from largely accept immigrants who come from high educational levels, high educational backgrounds. Whereas in Europe, throughout most of Europe, immigrants were very, very unskilled, uneducated immigrants were imported en masse to do jobs that Europeans didn't want to do in post-war, to solve the post-war labor shortages. And so you've got, for example, Turkish immigrants in Germany are coming from the poorest areas of rural Turkey, the not at all sophisticated Europeanized Turks, like the kind who might emigrate to the United States, but people for whom even moving to Istanbul would have been a huge culture shock. They're coming from little villages. They're coming in the case of Britain, you have someone like Zia, who I describe in my book, who comes from a tiny village in Sylhet province in Bangladesh. And this is a culture clash which is enormous. It's not just the culture clash of Islam and a basically Christian society. It's a clash of complete lack of development and developed society.
Do you think this is part of what's going on in France with some of the riots with the young Muslims?
Sure. Of course it is. Part of what's going on in France, though, also is a very French thing. The French mm-hmm. like to riot. They always have.
Mm-hmm. And why is that?
Well, it's a long French tradition. Mm-hmm. France has always seen people taking to the streets, and it's always tolerated that. And for a lot of French people, I think it's a lot of fun.
Okay. Not my idea of fun, but I think that's sort of interesting, given that you described a waiter who was catching a thief one day, and the police officer sort of shook his hand and lectured him for stopping a thief,
mm-hmm.
and told him that, you know, here we have French law.
Yes, you have. you have French law and French custom, which are very distinctive, and French custom permits certain kinds of explosions of liberation from the law every now and again.
Rioting being one of them.
Extremely disciplined society, and that kind of discipline does exact a psychological cost. And the way that the society deals with it is through... Helen, I'm sure you see this on a personal level.
Right.
You see people who are just wound up too tightly.
Right.
And then they
explode over the smallest thing.
Exactly. And that's what you're seeing at a national level in France.
But wouldn't it be better to sort of moderate your feelings all along? I mean, maybe the French need a national therapist to get over there and help them out?
In some ways, every country I've ever seen needs a national therapist to help them out. And there's particular neuroses in every given country. That one is the French one, and the riots should, in some sense, be interpreted through that prism.
Well, part of it, though, from what I've understood from people that I've talked to over in France, is that there's just a great deal of discrimination, apparently, against some of the young Muslims.
Uh-huh. Absolutely there is. Mm-hmm. Absolutely there is.
And yet, at the same time, there's discrimination, and then there's also the welfare state that sort of keeps them...
Unemployed.
Yes.
Unemployed. As much as... unemployment rates rise to as much as 50% in certain areas, and that's deadly. You can't have that many young, frustrated men running around.
Mm-hmm.
Not, you know, it's just deadly to a society to have young men in large groups thinking they have no future and with too much time on their hands.
Right, and you talked specifically in your book about Muslim men having really expressing their anger outwardly and the women somewhat more inwardly.
Yeah, I mentioned that rates of suicide among Muslim women are the highest in Britain, or are the highest of any demographic group that's measured in mental health categories like that. And I think that's very significant.
What does it tell us, do you think, about the women there and their feelings?
Well, I think it suggests that it's very, very difficult to be a young woman coming from a Muslim background in an open Western society. You certainly see what you don't have,
mm-hmm.
and you want it.
Mm-hmm.
It's natural. Anyone wants to be freer than you are if you're a Muslim woman or a traditional Muslim woman.
So you think they take their lives out of the frustration of not having their liberty?
Well, I think that's certainly part of it. If you're a young teenager in Britain or in Europe, you want to do what teenagers do. You want to date. You want to go out by yourself unescorted. You don't. The treatment of some, not all, but some women in Muslim households is just horrifying. With brutality, rape, forced marriages. It's really, to the Western mind, and I think correctly, grotesque. And if you are living that way and able to see that it could be another way, of course it's going to drive you insane.
Right. Kind of like, I mean, going along the same lines, Theo van Gogh, his movie, short film that you said it was pretty bad Submission. You know, it talks about some of these problems with women, you know, the Muslim women and what they go through. But, you know, it's interesting that I think that his death was very symbolic. Can you kind of speak to that and talk about maybe some of the symbolism of his death and what that might mean?
Well, absolutely. The name Van Gogh, what does it suggest to you? It's one of the... Van Gogh's achievements were among the most glorious achievements of Western civilization. And when you have a descendant of Van Gogh murdered in the streets for defending Western civilization, I think it's iconic. It's a tragedy in and of itself, but it's also a tragedy in a much broader sense. It's as if someone put a dagger in the heart of Western civilization.
Well, yes, and I think that the fact that his assassin was a welfare recipient and he was sort of nurtured by the Dutch government on one hand, and he was receiving welfare, and then he sort of, I don't know. To me, it just seems like to kill someone like that is sort of a representation of just everything, the clash of cultures.
It is, absolutely. It was a very significant event.
Let me
not
shift,
a surprising one, but a very significant one.
Let me shift for a second to the subject of Germany, which, of course, has been the source of many problems in Europe over millennia. You sort of look at what's going on in Germany, where there's a particular... resentment of America for a variety of complicated reasons, and you look at a German, what would you call it, a crypto-Nazi death metal band called Rammstein, and you know, how even though they talk about pacifism, they're really drawing on a lot of Nazi imagery and even Nazi critiques of America. I mean, where do you think all that comes from and is going?
This is a very interesting phenomenon. And you're looking at, when you look at Germany, you're looking at, as Jeffrey Gedman said to me, I interviewed Jeffrey Gedman for my book, he said he's looking at a country that committed an act of insanity for 13 years and has never really recovered from that, never recovered from the shame and the guilt and the, how can I put this, it's never recovered from the horror of what it did, and it has recoiled on the world stage, embracing a pacifism, but on the other hand, it is Germany has always occupied a certain position of power in Europe, and the conflict between what Germans want geopolitically and their shame is causing enormous neurosis, and I think that's expressed in something like Rammstein's art.
What about the fact that, you know, I guess the band talks about, I thought this was an interesting concept. You say, think with your heart, which was one of the National Socialist Speakers Corps. They used to talk to people and say, you know, think with your heart. And I think that's really interesting because when you really want to appeal to someone, you really try to get them not to think logically. And I think we do that in this country also. We don't think logically. Sometimes we think more with our feelings. And, you know, I just think it's interesting that the National Socialist Party used that to sort of as propaganda.
Absolutely. I mean, it's one of the hallmarks of German fascism that the citizen was enjoined to abandon reason and to submit with his heart. And the words think with your heart are so associated with that period in history.
But it seems to me, I mean, that sometimes people do that. I think there are, you know, even people here in the United States, and they try to get people to think or to think with feelings. And I never quite understand it, because when you try to talk to somebody, sometimes they use so much more with feelings than they do with any type of logic. Do you think that's something that is changing either in Europe or the United States, that people don't use logic or critical thinking as much?
Is that changing?
Or do you think it's always been there?
There are always going to be people who are more inclined toward an emotional understanding of the world and people who are more inclined toward an intellectual understanding of the world. And I think that the ratio of those is probably going to be unchanging. But there are mass movements in history that have focused on encouraging people to submit to a kind of orgiastic passion. And those are particularly dangerous.
Mm-hmm. And how does one inoculate themselves against that?
That's a very good question. Answer that question, it's probably useful to go back and look at the people who did resist the Nazis.
Mm-hmm.
Many of them came from religious backgrounds. Many of them were just blessed with a special moral intuition.
Well, let me ask you a sort of instrumental question here. If you were able to give advice to leading U.S. diplomatic officials in the White House or the State Department, briefly, what would you tell them they should do in terms of dealing with Europe?
Make contingency plans. Make contingency plans in case it all goes to hell, because it very well might. Have plans in effect to go it alone, because you might have to. That's what I'd say.
So there are sort of three possible futures for Europe you hear about. I mean, one of them is a sort of reversion to fascism, which you see signs of in some of the German imagery. There's another threat that people talk about, the conversion of Europe to Eurabia.
Uh-huh.
And then I guess the other possibility is that they'll just sort of muddle through. Do you have any idea of which of these is more likely?
Well, intuitively, it's always very hard to imagine things changing that much. And living in Europe, it's very hard to really imagine, despite what I see around me, that Europe would not be Europe in 50 years' time. But I know historically that's been a very bad intuition. I know that historically someone looking around in 1933 and saying, oh, Europe will always be just the way it is, would have been so wrong. So I think it's appropriate to be extremely, extremely worried and cautious.
Well, that's really encouraging.
Sorry.
Well, at least you're calling attention to the problem, and thanks so much for taking the time to join us.
Oh, we done already? Okay.
Well, one more question then. The whole project of European integration seems like it's kind of come a cropper, and in your book, I noticed one of your themes is that Europe's really not so much the same, that people are dealing very differently with these problems in very different places, and what do you have to say about all that?
That's certainly true. The idea of a European superstate is, honestly, it's nuts. It doesn't reflect the will of a single nation state. These are all unique nation states with very different historical traditions, completely different languages, and they've all hated each other historically. And the idea of melding them into one peaceful superstate without any central political entity to dominate the periphery. It's just not going to happen that way. And we see this very concretely with the rejection of the European Constitution in several referendums, starting with France and then moving on to the Netherlands.
Well, you know, the European integration project kind of makes me think of an effort by the European elites to restore the kind of transnational aristocracy that they had before World War I, only with the Eurocrats in the position that the old hereditary nobility used to have. Well, yeah, what do you think of that?
I think that's very important insight. You have people coming from the same families, the same educational system, occupying the same positions of unelected privilege, and thinking in exactly the same ways, just as they did before. And that's a very important point of historical continuity, and one that didn't work out so well before.
I guess not. Well, that's not very encouraging either, but you haven't been that cheerful here today.
Well, you know, the food is really good in Italy.
Well, we've had a lovely time there, and we actually have family in France, and we enjoy visiting them, and I guess that's one reason why we wish things looked a little better.
Yeah.
But we sure appreciate you joining us. And
thank you so much.
Thanks for being with us, and we look forward to having you back again.
Well, thank you.
Thanks a lot.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks.
Well, that was certainly depressing, but at least it's a wake-up call.
Yeah, you can't address a problem until you admit it's there, and there have been a lot of people in Europe and in the United States who've been in denial about what's going on. I hope Berlinski's book gets a lot of circulation there, and certainly here. So buy the book, read it, and, well, you'll be a little depressed, but you'll certainly know a lot more about what's going on. We hope you enjoyed this podcast anyway. We'll be back with another one whenever we get around to it. You can check for updates at instapundit.com or drhelen.blogspot.com. You can subscribe via iTunes, we like that, or via Podcast Alley, Yahoo, or a variety of other services. In the meantime, have fun out there.
Talk to you next time.